Welcome to the Sendcast. My name is Dale Pickles and I'm the host of the Sendcast and director of B Squared. If you are a new listener, then welcome to the Sendcast. The aim of this podcast is really, really simple. We want to reach lots and lots of people and help you all learn more about special educational needs and disability. The main focus of the podcast is to increase the knowledge of teachers and schools, but the podcast supports all professionals working with children or young people with SEND, and it benefits parents and carers of all children. In this episode, I'm discussing teacher styles for supporting SEN and behaviour with one of my regular guests, Fintan O'Regan. For those who don't know Fintan, he has been a head teacher, lecturer for Leicester University, and now works as a trainer consultant for schools and school support systems. The Sendcast is created and produced by us here at B Squared. We are the assessment people. We help schools to show the small steps of progress pupils with SEND make, and we help them to do this for a wide range of abilities and ages. And if you're a primary school struggling to show progress or struggling to identify where a pupil isn't making progress, we can help. But did you know you can use B Squared's assessment software for more than just your pupils with SEND? You can now assess all pupils in primary schools in one system, saving you time, saving you money, and simplifying the whole assessment process, saving you lots of time on that data. Visit the B Squared website or click on the meeting link in the show notes to book a meeting with me to take you through our assessment software. Now, let's get on with the podcast. On this week's show, we're discussing teacher styles for supporting SEN and behaviour. Are you a controller, a friend, or a benevolent dictator? My guest this week is Fintan O'Regan. Fintan is back and he is a trainer consultant for schools and school support systems, including social services, health, the police, and foster carers. And before this, he worked with a number of organisations, including NATION, Institute of Education, Leicester University, the UK ADHD Network, and the European ADHD Alliance. And before this, he was a head teacher of a specialist school for students with ADHD, ASD, and ODD. And now he spends his life talking about all of his experiences before and helping improve lives of others. Welcome back to the show, Fintan.
Thank you very much, Dale. Thank you for inviting me.
You are welcome. We all remember different teachers from our childhood. Some teachers were lots of fun, some were just scary, and some were firm but still nice. Their style had an impact on us, but they can have a much bigger impact on pupils with SEND.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as you say, we've all had a favourite teacher. We've all had a teacher that we probably still talk about who influenced us, you know, in terms of not just what they taught us, but what they taught us about the subject, what they taught us maybe about life and about interaction. And we've had some teachers who I think we probably would probably, you know, we used to make fun of or we don't certainly regard in the same way. I think if you are a traditional learner, obviously you do tend to sort of concentrate a little bit more and possibly on maybe the subject anyway than the person delivering it. And therefore you're going to maybe like certain subjects and like certain subjects because of the teacher a bit more, but you're probably going to like the subject. I think when it comes to children with SEN who may struggle with accessing the curriculum, accessing, you know, the actual information and how they might get it, the teacher is absolutely even more crucial in terms of how you would either maximise or minimise your potential.
I think for me, it's very much how that teacher was. It was how engaging they made that subject. I do think lots of people choose subjects based on their teachers.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Particularly at secondary school, when you're starting to have to make some decisions, you know, when you're moving into year 9, 10, 11, 12, and it's massively influential. And I think you can get also turned off subjects very early on by having some experiences in year 7 and year 8, so particularly again at secondary school with a teacher who just cannot deliver the subject, or certainly doesn't want to sort of adapt things if you find it difficult, which is often going to be the case if you have, you know, aspects of literacy or numeracy difficulties in terms of processing and memory. And of course, that old attention span and, you know, teachers who are boring, as you know, will probably be less effective, particularly if you have a learning style where you have a low threshold of boredom.
Definitely. So you've given me three terms to describe these teachers. The controller, the friend, and the benevolent dictator.
There was also the optimist, the competitive one, the dull as dishwater, and the explosive, but we'll save those for another time. So those three main categories are a teacher style that I've kind of adapted from a book called Teacher's Toolkit from Paul McGuinness some years ago. But it also is very reflective of some of the teachers that I see when I work in schools with training, because you tend to find, particularly in secondary schools, you've got three types of teacher. Particularly in training, you tend to find you've got those that kind of get the quirky kids, those that sort of, you know, enjoy the kids who are different. You've got those that are real subject specialists that really want everyone to, and they think everyone should learn like they did. And they don't really enjoy the students who are different and are a bit suspicious of them and see them as disrupting everyone else's work. And you've got those in the middle just being consistent, not quite buying into why he or she doesn't get it. Some days they get it, some days they don't. And it's almost like that inconsistency is really something that as a trainer, you really do need to sort of like focus on that group, because the first group are kind of with you anyway. The third, the middle group, actually, the ones I mentioned who are, you know, more on the sort of subject specialist, they need a deeper dive. They need a real reason about why some people do learn differently. And the last group are the ones you pitch at, because you want to get them to really sort of understand what's in it for them to be more consistent. And that they shouldn't be, you know, they are more in the friend group. You know, it's not about being important to be liked. It's important about being respected. And you get respect by being consistent and understanding the needs of the child in front of you. And so they need to firm up. They need to be more consistent. And once you've got two groups, you're on your way. As I said, the group that are more subject specialists, they need a deeper dive altogether to understand why someone is different. And those would be the people who I'm sort of putting in the controller group at this time, and we can talk about those groups in a bit more detail in a minute.
So I suppose the controller is the person who's teaching the subject, not the child.
Yeah, very much so. And there could be an argument about, you know, why there is this aspect of some teachers being, as I said, very much more interested in the subject than the people who they're working with. And it's kind of, that's the sort of one, the teacher that says the don't smile till Christmas, it's my way or the highway type thing. There's no plan B. There's no, you know, and if someone is being disruptive or different, they kind of send them to someone else. To a certain extent as well, those are the sort of teachers who, when you're talking to them as a head teacher about what was going on, it wasn't really about the child. It was really more about how it was affecting them. You know, how it was affecting them and what they perceived was the needs of the others as well. So you could argue they might be a little on the spectrum-ish themselves in terms of reading situations and reading people. But then I just want to make the point that's not, you know, that's not an official sort of like assessment. That's just an unofficial assessment.
I think it is. When we think of the controller, you literally are thinking of the old Victorian style teachers. Everything should be in rows. Everything. Zero tolerance behavior type stuff.
Yeah, very, very much so. And if I interrupt you there for a minute, I think that philosophy, unfortunately, as you know, as a person that I've cited quite a few times in these podcasts, you know, Mr. Bennett, you know, has to a certain extent, you know, as the behaviors are, has certainly supported that kind of no tolerance approach. And that has been, you know, that's been his philosophy. He had some success with schools adopting that particular idea, which is what we've seen, you know, on another podcast again, you know, in terms of how we responded to situations in SEN, and it certainly, in, you know, influenced the exclusion figures that we've been seeing going up and up for many years.
And I do believe actually the controller, where you've written children should be seen and not heard, don't smile till Christmas, they're just like their parents. If one person gets away with it, they all will do it, and it's a battle and I am to win it, perfectly describes him as well.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't possibly comment as was said before.
I've never met him. I'm just going by how the interactions happen on social media.
Yeah, I mean, and he's very successful on social media, and I give him credit for being good on, you know, that, using that medium. Here's a guy who we shouldn't be, but he does sort of, we were talking earlier about how people have their past experiences and how it influences maybe some of their responses and, you know, in terms of their work and the policies and procedures. But he does quite like this idea of he likes to say he was, you know, in a tough school and he was a tough guy and he was a bouncer in a nightclub. And that kind of approach of bouncing people out is kind of still seemingly being somewhat what he's been, you know, purporting over the years. Now, again, and what I'm slightly irked about, you don't have to be, anyone can have an opinion on behavior, and we should all have our own influences in that. But when you're influencing the behavior of systems and schools and you know, and maybe chains of academies and things like that. And also he will talk about how, you know, he needs to train head teachers. Now, he's never been a head teacher. And, you know, so some of the sort of like things that he will be explaining that you should do as a head teacher, and having not actually actively having had the opportunity to follow through and actually make a decision about an exclusion, for example, and how the responsibility of that is on the individual making that decision and on the family, it just seems to be, you know, the wrong way around. Just seems to be the wrong way around.
So if we step down a little bit from a controller, so kind of we start with that mentality of I have my rules and this is how it's going to be, but actually what I'm seeing is I need to tweak what I'm doing slightly. I need to actually say you're not where I am. We kind of get into a benevolent dictator, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things, stories I'll say on that. When I was a head at Centre Academy, and we were the school where students came to after they had been excluded from other schools, I would say to the students who were a bit bitter and weren't particularly supportive of the whole school system, I'd say, well, who was your favourite teacher? And they used to say to me, I hate all teachers, they all hate me. Well, it's not a good start in the conversation. So I would say to them, so which teacher did you hate the least? And they would usually say someone you knew you were with, someone you could have a laugh with, and someone who basically seemed to sort of get me and stop the others from bothering me. Sorry, that was the other one they'd say. They would get me and stop the others from bothering me. And you were thinking, hang on that last point, weren't you the one that hit him, which is the reason you're here? But there was, what they were basically saying was it was someone who could kind of read the room, because these were the students who would react, who would possibly, you know, overreact. And what this teacher was doing was he was understanding that he had who the players in the room were and how they were winding up the one who ended up reacting. And the other thing they were saying, that someone you who was consistent, you knew you were with, and someone you could have a laugh with on some occasion. So I think that's really what they were saying. And then the other example of this is that when I used to look at some past teacher reports, when students came in for an assessment at our school, a lot of the reports would say about Dale, they'd say, oh, we can do it when he wants to. He's, you know, he's impulsive. He's a bit stubborn sometimes, or he's, you know, they were generally kind of negative comments, and usually telling a parent what the parent already knew, which is another, could be another podcast really on school report writing. Why do we tell people you can't sit still when the parent's going to be fully aware of that? But there's usually one report that says, Dale does a good job in my class. And you say to the parent, and they say to them, well, you've got this one report shining through that says that he's successful, he's compliant, he's doing. Who was this teacher? Who was this super teacher? And it was the same sort of characteristics of the one I described before. It was a teacher who was pretty firm, but were consistent. You know, the kids liked them because they said they knew who they were with. They, you know, knew where they were with them. They were fair, or perceived as fair. And you know, they seem to be someone who occasionally you could have some fun with. So it was kind of firm, fair, and fun, really. But the other thing was unusual. I used to ask a little bit more, what does a teacher look like, or whatever. I just asked that question. But there was a real common theme that they were often always around about. It was often a woman, particularly because it had been in the primary school that these reports were written often, and sometimes in secondary. But they always seem to be around about 5'2". And here's the other weird thing. They were almost always Scottish. And I have no idea what to do with that information other than to share that with you. So I used to have this kind of Miss Jean Brodie sort of like figure who was out there. But they were basically benevolent dictators.
I'm going to come back to some of my teachers later. But the third one you've got is the friend. So basically, as we step down from the controller to the benevolent dictator, we kind of lost the rigidity, lost the mask that you've put on. We've become a human. We've got the rules, but we're being realistic. We're making reasonable adjustments. But then if we go keep going, we kind of lose those rules, don't we? And we just become a friend.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on which order we do this in. I usually do the control of friend and benevolent to show the sort of like the sort of like the what I perceive as the most effective style. But the point, it doesn't. We've covered that. See, the friend is an interesting character because they kind of want to be liked, and because of that, they're inconsistent. And it's almost like the classroom is democracy, where ownership of the classroom is up for grabs. You know, some days they're on it, some days they're not. You don't know where you are with them. But the most important thing, it leads to uncertainty and insecurity, because in my experience, kids, they like structure, they like routines, they like rules. It's how it's delivered. And that's what the benevolent dictator does. So the friend it's a little bit wishy-washy, if you see what I mean. And partly that comes from the fact that they don't quite understand the needs of the child, which is what I'm saying, is they're in that kind of that middle band of uncertainty about what they do. And actually, they can become much more effective with training, actually, in terms of helping them understand why the boundaries are important, why it's really important to keep it as tight as you can at the end of term, summer term, Christmas term, as possible. Because as you know, when you get loose, that's when the problems take place. So, you know, they are individuals for whom training is really important. Whereas the benevolent dictator, a lot of the training you're doing is confirming what they do anyway. And as I said before, and the controller needs a much deeper dive.
I think, yeah, to me, the controller and the friend are the extremes, and benevolent dictator is taking the best of each and bringing it together. And I think some teachers become that benevolent dictator through either stumbling into it, just from their experience of going, actually, when I was doing that day, I had a really big impact. Others, it comes through from that training. You're dragging them from one of the others. But I don't think anyone really starts out as a benevolent dictator, probably. They probably start the other two and move into it.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there are some people who are naturally gifted when it comes to dealing with people and scenarios. But as I said before, I think we often, we've been looking at other areas in terms of how people get into the SEN world for many years. But I do think that, you know, when you're trained as a teacher, I think the one thing that is a bit confusing is sometimes people assess you for your knowledge of your knowledge of the subject. They assess you for your paperwork, your organization, your ability to write a lesson plan. But are they really assessing you for your people skills? And I think if you're going to be working with people, little people, quite smaller people, you need to have people who are interested in other people, I would have thought. And having people skills in terms of, you know, de-escalation and reading the room, I think that's pretty important, actually. And I think you're right. I think no one starts off thinking, and the word dictator obviously may be a bit strong, but it's somebody who has the ability to understand that what individuals generally, particularly SEN children, but all children, they want someone to be firm, fair, and occasionally go off piste a bit, you know, to be funny or to have a joke or not take themselves so seriously. If they get it wrong, to explain they got it wrong. And there's a couple of things I would say is not taking it personally. I'm afraid the controller is often taking it very personally. The friend, often it's kind of like, I thought we had a relationship and now you've done this to me. You know, it's kind of like, whereas the benevolent dictator just doesn't take it personally. You know, they like the child. They might not like what the child has done, that they've dissociated those two things. And also the benevolent dictator understands this term that fairness isn't given everyone the same. It's given them what they need. And some kids will need more than others. Some kids will, if you have an inhaler, if you have asthma, you need an inhaler to breathe. If you have eye issues, you have glasses to read. Some people will need a timeout card. Some people will need, you know, lessons broken down in the way. Some people will need something to fidget like Dale does, you know, during a lesson. That's fair to do that because someone is different. The controller, you know, doesn't sees that as them getting away with it or they're pulling the wool over your eyes and it's not fair and all the other kids will rise up in a revolution if you don't stamp down on this fiddling thing. And there'll be, and the friend is again just inconsistent and doesn't do it on a regular basis.
So I would say if we think of, I'm literally going through all my teachers and I think of early years, year one, I'm thinking you want friends. Yeah. For that introduction to school, friends is what you want in early years.
Yeah, I would suspect, although Yes, you do. Although I would qualify that by also saying that the early years teachers are far more developmentally aware of individuals than possibly your secondary school teacher is. They are thinking, they're not just thinking age means that someone has the abilities of the other, their peers. I think they do think developmentally far more. And because of that, you know, and I think, listen, we want to make distinction between friendly and being their friend. You know, yeah. I mean, friendly is being kind. It is being supportive. It is being understanding. But they don't need you to be their friend. They've got friends. They're the same age as them. And therefore, that's the people they need. So it's important to be friendly, kind, considerate, caring, whatever situation you're in. And I would say that teachers generally at the earlier level will go into that area because they are more child-centered than they are more subject-orientated. I want to make the point as well that there are some great subject teachers out there, you know, who've got the whole package. We're not just saying it's, you know, at one level that people will have this. And there'll also be some controlling early year teachers as well. But as you're right, the percentage of them would be very different.
And as I think, once you kind of get into year two and above, you always want the benevolent dictator. And we could almost rename them to the reasonable adjuster.
Yeah, I think so. It's someone that you know, as you know, that doesn't see structure and flexibility as contradictory. They see them as complementary. You know, that is, I have a sort of a band one and band two criteria when it comes to helping children with neurodivergency. And band one are the non-negotiables. It doesn't matter if you're ADHD, ODD, BBC, MTV, ITV. You know, there's going to be some things that are non-negotiable in the classroom that are health and safety awareness, but other things in band two, and these things aren't crimes against humanity. And those are the people who are making, as you say, the reasonable adjustments through flexible approaches of how to help children who are neurodivergent learn. So I think that the benevolent dictator really understands that structure and flexibility. And just putting it another way, they read the room.
Yeah. It's that reading the room with rules are the two bits I think are really important, because you might think of reasonable adjustment as SEN and things like that, but actually reasonable adjustment is, I'm talking that reading the room is for every pupil in that classroom. Back in my day, the classrooms were always silent. Whereas these days, some teachers will put music on, because I personally cannot work in silence. I need something. If there's silence, my head is looking for something. Whether I like it or not, my head is listening. Oh, is there mowing the lawn outside? Oh, that clock's really loud today. Oh, somebody's in the corridor. I wonder what they're doing. Whether I like it or not, music on, for I think lots of people, fills that void. But also it means that if two people are having a little whisper conversation, they can have it without impacting others. Where when it's silent and people are talking, it becomes like a shh battle for the next hour and a half.
Well, you just kind of described that last bit, the controller, haven't you, really, how the controller views it. And there is no doubt that a lot of what I'm maybe saying here is going to dovetail with other things that you might have listened to. And it's about someone, you know, who understands that it's not about behavior management, it's about managing mood, as you know, Dale.
Yep.
And when you do, you know, and if it's not working, that's what flexibility means. Then you have to be adaptive. And you have to make some different changes to your system, and not just sort of like machete on and carry on doing more of the same. And I think that's what your benevolent dictator does. It, you know, they basically adjust things to suit the not just the requirements of the kids, but change the mood to a certain extent. Also, the other, you know, other area that, as you know, we talk about quite a bit is reduce the boredom, you know, and have distractions. And it's not meaning that they're not diluting the message of teaching. They're just doing it in a way that's getting that across. And we go back to the SEN versus the traditional learner. I mean, you could argue that, you know, some traditional learners could literally have a robot teaching them, really, because they don't need necessarily, everyone needs the rapport and trust of a human, in my view, but they will do it, you know, no matter what the circumstance. Whereas the children with SEN, they really need an adult. Or a, you know, doesn't have to be an adult, I suppose, really. It could be an older child, I suppose, but because teachers are generally speaking adults, someone who's able to be adaptive, who can be responsive, to different situations and individuals who learn differently.
Now, I've got a big problem with the controller from my personal experience. So the scariest teacher I ever met and would ever meet is my mum.
We didn't expect that.
And no matter what you could ever do as a teacher will ever meet, get to anywhere near my, how my mum used to make me feel. So my mum was a teacher and she was scary. She'd get in your face. She'd do all the very probably typical controller things. Problem is, as a parent, if I didn't listen, she could then smack me, which she did. So, but problem is, when I was about 11 or 12, I learned that this was a performance. This was a gear my mum used to get into. This was the, you've done something wrong, I'm stepping it up gear. And all I had to do was just nod politely and say sorry when it was appropriate and go to my room. So by the time 11 or 12, I basically, to me, I could do anything I want. I just had to put up with this being shouted at for a period of time. And then I went to school, and at my school, there were two teachers. One of them was 5 foot and Scottish, but she was very scary.
5 foot two?
Probably 5 foot two. Okay. I was taller than her. But I remember seeing her, this was early 90s, I remember seeing her holding an older pupil by the ear and walking him through the corridor. Yep. So scary and Scottish. Everyone was scared of her. And then the head of maths, everyone was scared of her. I was annoying. But I was also distracted. One day I got detention because I saw a seven-legged spider. To me, that was quite interesting.
That is a pretty interesting story. By the way, and the not all, we're talking about the Scottish people here. We're just talking about a style of person who, on the benevolent dictator side.
Yes. But, yeah. No, she wasn't a benevolent. She was a controller.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. So we can. So we're making the point that you can go across all cultures as well.
And I got into trouble, and I remember being shouted at. It was about year 8 or year 9 by this teacher, and Mrs. Highton, her office was between two classrooms, glass walls. She is bellowing at me. She is putting on the performance of a lifetime, and it had zero effect on me. I spent the entire time not laughing. That's all I could think of is do not laugh. And that was the thing is, I knew that from here, all she could really do is send me to the head teacher or do something like that. It's like, there are no consequences in school. My mum could smack me, but even that didn't really. So this is the problem with when you're being a controller is, where do you go from here? Once you've got used to this level, where do you go?
Well, that's one of the issues. One of the things we say about controllers are they haven't got a plan B, and when it doesn't work, they send them someone else. And I think, as you're right, you know, the students, after a while, like yourself, will work this out, and therefore you just don't get the respect, if you like, and you certainly don't get rapport with the student that you're clashing with. And generally speaking, you don't really possibly get that respect either from the other students in the room, because they see inconsistencies and they see those things. And even though it's not them being affected by it, it's certainly going to affect their feeling about the person who is in charge of the room. So I think, you know, it's a classic case. So what did you then do as a result of that? How was your, did you only have this particular teacher for that year? Did you see them afterwards?
I never had her as a teacher. I had the short Scottish person as a teacher, and she was half controller and half 11 dictator. She kind of got it, but the moment you crossed that rule, she went full on controller mode. So as soon as you upset her, she turned controller. As long as she was happy, she was benevolent dictator. But if you crossed her, it went to the controller. But I used to get sent to the head of maths a number of times. And I got called various things by her. It was not a great relationship. But I really didn't care. And that's the thing is, what I would say is, however scary you think you are as a teacher, whatever message you think you are trying to give, it's probably not the one being received by that child.
Yeah, very much so.
For me anyway, which I would then probably go for neurodiverse, who are probably, for typical children, I think most children were scared of these teachers. But it just was nothing. It was just really interesting how that worked in my head, that I really, it had no impact.
Well, I think if we're saying that, you know, as a year seven and year eight student, the speech is still a bit scary, the bigger kids in the secondary school, and therefore I think the adults do have more kind of, you know, they will be looked at slightly differently than if you become a year nine student and you think, well, what's the worst that can happen to me? You know, I'll be sent out, I'll go to the exclusion room or go to the reflection room or whatever. And I'd rather be in there anyway, because, you know, I want to avoid this person. And I think just making this point, as you said, that, you know, there's not a problem in having occasionally some of the controlling traits, you know, and some of the friend traits. That's not there. You've got to have it's. But if you're doing it all the time, then that's when you start to, you know, hit the buffers. And what we're saying is, I think, as you pointed out, the benevolent dictator does take both elements of those things and uses them as a combination, but is, again, you know, much more consistent and in how they deliver situations on a regular basis. And it's not about, you know, it's not about them. It's about the child. It's about, and also they don't let their own mood, if you like, affect the circumstances. They are professional enough to deal with these situations on its own merits. Whereas I do think that the other two types of teachers, it's very much about their mood that affects the outcome of how they deal with the, you know, with Dale or Dales.
I was just thinking, it was a phrase you hear, I'm not angry, I'm disappointed. And I think when I think about the three, the controller is they get angry. If you do something wrong with a friend, they'll probably be sad. But I think when that benevolent dictator, because they're getting to know you and they're reasonable adjustment, they will be disappointed in you. And I think in reality, that's the bit you don't want. As a child, I didn't have a problem making a teacher angry. I didn't have a problem making someone sad. But once I built that, once that teacher built that relationship with me, I didn't want to disappoint them.
I would say that those three ways, those three descriptions, angry, sad, and disappointed, are fit very well. I think it's absolutely right. You form the relationship. You don't want to let the benevolent dictator down. And you know, sometimes them just nodding and an expression of you say, looking disappointed or looking, you know, not sort of like, not emotionally giving you a lot back, but giving you so much back. In that area of just looking, you know, as you said, that word is point. Whereas the angry and the sad, you've kind of achieved your objective, if you like, really, in getting someone to that point. And when someone's sad, again, it goes back to the fact with the friend, it's too democratic. And kids don't want a democracy. They don't want as much a dictatorship, but they want someone to run the room. They want someone to run the room, and they like structure, they like rules, they like routines. And, you know, it's your room. It's not their room. You know, you're the person who's employed to deliver that lesson, to run that class. As I said, you know, you don't have to be mean how you do it. You can be kind and caring, but you do need to be the leader of, you need to be a coach and a leader. That's what you need to be, a coach and a leader. And that's what a benevolent dictator is. They're a coach and they're a leader.
All of my favorite teachers, without a doubt, are all benevolent dictators. So Mr. Spikesman, my year five teacher, I got in trouble putting a pin on someone's chair. I got told off, but I felt I'd let him down. That's the thing, I remember that. I remember I got pushed off a bouncy castle, but he was one who was a first aider and he looked after me. He shared a lot of himself with us in terms of what he was interested in. So he was the first teacher who I felt was a human and I knew something about them. He completely changed our class assemblies. He was just literally my first favorite teacher was him, without a doubt. But the next year I had year six and I had my first Welsh teacher, Mr. Young, who was very typical teachery. He wore like a tweed jacket with patches. He was, in my head, he was probably 50, very strict Welsh sounding, full on Welsh. And everyone made him sound like a controller. We were all scared of him lower down the school. He wasn't. It was just, he has rules. He has his, as you say, level one rules. You don't cross them. Everything else, he adjusts and he adapts. But as long as you don't cross those rules, everything was great. And we did the Year 6 Residential and we did lots of really fun things. And he was amazing in so many ways. And then Year 7, Mr. Birchall. He was my next Welsh teacher. And he was my former tutor. He supported Port Vale. I had to look about who they were. He was really nice. I think it was his first job. We would make him angry and he would shout at us. And it was like he was trying to be a controller, but he just couldn't. And we fell into, as a class and him, we fell into this relationship of winding each other up in a nice way. When he pushed us, he became that controller. He went into that, which is what you need. But apart from that, he was our friend. It was a really good reading the room. He was also my RE teacher, and I do not believe in God, and I took the mickey out of it. And he just dealt with it in a way that was really well. That meant I didn't hate RE, although I didn't believe in it. I didn't like it. It was all, he was really good. And then but most of my teachers at secondary were trying to be controllers and it didn't work and they didn't have the relationship. And the one person who I really think of at my secondary school was a science teacher, Mr. Sowen, who was just one of those mad scientists who was passionate about his subject and he shared it with you. And he was on a boat near Iceland when an underwater, basically an island was being formed. And he was there and he showed us photos. He taught us the longest word in the dictionary, anti-establishmentarianism, I think. But he would also do really mad stuff in the classroom, but he also had his rules. So it was that he shared with us who he was and we were interested, but he had his rules. And most of those teachers, which I've loved, have been like that, that there's nothing wrong with having those rules. You shouldn't have to make people feel that those rules are always there. They should be they come out when they're needed. Not, you shouldn't feel they're always there. It should be a nice environment. And you go up to that thunk, don't cross the first rules, but you might cross these second rules, but he'll bring it back without it being. And that's that benevolent dictator part, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you've said a lot in there and I'd start off with the fact that, you know, you said early on about not wanting to let someone down. And I think that doesn't come overnight. That comes with, you know, building a relationship, building the rapport. But I think that comes with the consistency, the structure, the rules, the routine. So people feel safe and secure. So that's why you got to have that, those boundaries to make people feel safe and secure. And then it's all about how you deliver it. And it strikes me that we're going through the regions today now. We've talked about the Scottish, we've talked about the Welsh. There's obviously lots of English and Irish and other nationalities for us to consider. And we all have our own style as teachers. You know, we all will have our own unique style, our delivery, our timing of how we deliver, you know, both the curriculum and how we deliver instructions. I mean, you know, it's like watching someone sing the same song on one of these sort of like celebrity. Everyone sings it differently. It's the same song. We'll all deliver it in a different way, different pitch, different tone, different nuances. And, you know, so we will all have unique styles. But there are some characteristics that what we're doing today is we've defined three major different overall styles that can either significantly maximize the potential, particularly of non-traditional learners, or can minimize it. And I think that's really what we're trying to say. I think the other thing, just to make the point, is that, you know, these are categories that have been created, really, you know, not officially, unofficially. It's more like a journey we're on. But, you know, but it is very much, as you all know, with non-traditional learners, neurodiverse learners, it's not what you do, it's how it's done, I think, that's really important. And it's who delivers it. And I think we all know that for students that have struggled in school, particularly those, there used to be in the TES every week about a child who had usually some celebrity, a sporting or an actor, who had struggled in school. And they always say, there was someone who believed in me. It was someone who believed in me. And I, you know, therefore reacted accordingly to them, you know, and how they've developed the relationship. I mean, the controller, as we said before, the traits that we have in controllers and friends are both to be used at certain times, but it's the timing of them. And that's what you tend to find, that the benevolent dictator gets that timing right, because the controller is often coming up against someone who can be pretty sort of, you know, oppositional or defiant or disillusioned about school. And they go in as a North Pole, and they're meeting a North Pole. And when a North Pole meets a North Pole, it kind of clashes. And the friend can be sometimes going in, if you like, as a South Pole, too friendly, whereas what the kid needs is not someone, they want someone to tell them to do something different. And that's to say, whereas the benevolent dictator just seems to get the pole right. You know, if someone's coming in north, they go in south. If someone's going in south, they go in north. And they just seem to get the balance right.
And I think it's, when you talk about those sporting people who found someone who believed in them, in some way, you could say, well, they had a friend. No, they had a friend with expectations. Yeah. You can do better. Yeah. I'm being a friend, but you know you can do better. You know you need to do this. It's, when I was a governor, it was called the critical friend. But you need someone who, and my favorite one of those clips is a video of Ian Wright.
Oh, yeah.
On the footballs. And he goes, yeah. And he sees his teacher and he just pulls his hat off.
Exactly.
And becomes like a child. And you just see it's it's sir.
Yeah.
And they have a really lovely, so it's that level of respect. You immediately see it. Then you see the recognition and he wells up.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, again, I think if you haven't seen it, please check it out. It's very, very powerful. And as Dale's described, I think you have to believe, you won't believe it till you see it. He literally is for 30 seconds, he's transformed. A, he thought the guy wasn't. Be fair, also, he did believe the guy had passed away, so he did kind of thought he saw a ghost. But once he realized who it was, he actually did become that small child in front of that teacher. And I think you're absolutely right. Obviously, there was a great relationship between them. You could say he was a critical friend, but there was expectations there that he would be able to do on a regular basis. And he wasn't going to flinch, if you like, really, from not reminding him of what those expectations were. And that's what we're really talking about. That's what you are, a benevolent, you know, you're a friendly leader and a coach. That's what you are, but you are a leader and a coach.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is I've never been a teacher. I've looked at the workload. I went, no, thank you. But I loved being in the school where my mum was teaching. I loved going in and I loved it. And when I was at college, I used to do this IT support. I loved being in the school. I loved being around the kids. It was great. As my daughter grew up, I did coaching for football, which I ended up having to do on a Friday evening. So it was great because all the kids were tired from the end of the week and they just wanted to have fun at the weekend. And we had some neurodiverse kids on the team, which was lots of fun, and which meant I had to read the room every Friday. How bad, how stressful, how many late nights. Then the kids would come on the neurodiverse and it was, have they had a good day? And you just have to read the room and adjust to where they were. And I might have had a plan and I might have been able to do it, or I might have to completely throw that out the window, do something completely different. But it was always, there were expectations and I couldn't punish them. I couldn't exclude anyone. I couldn't do that. But we had rewards, yeah, and things like that. So we could do things like that. But it was about those relationships with those kids. It was always about, how are you to every child, and listening and trying to build that friendship, but making very clear I had these rules. And they responded really, really well. And it was. Whereas if you are the controller with just going mad with your whistle and shouting, they're not going to try for you.
Yeah, you
need that relationship to get them to really try. But if you're too nice, they're not going to try either. They're going to muck around.
Exactly. And that's another good analogy of it. And I think, you know, we've got to make this point. This doesn't happen in isolation. There's got to be, we do need to look at this in a slightly almost more holistic way. You know, a lot of it starts obviously with the leadership of the school, with the recruitment of staff, And then the retention of staff, the the training of staff, you know, it's particularly when it comes to the SEN world about why someone is different. And then it's about the policies and procedures and practices of the school. And, you know, because you can't be acting in isolation in one sense, you know, in if your colleagues, if you haven't got that backing of the senior leadership team in what you're doing in whatever way possible. And what we want our staff to be unique, but we want to be consistent too. So a lot of it isn't just the individual, it's the individual working within the framework of the school, because, you know, and there's this, you know, and it's sharing good practice too, I think. That's the issue. Not being, if you don't mind me saying, you do get some teachers who are really good at, you know, at working with some difficult, what other people say is difficult. But you know, it's not about ego or being smug about your skills. It's about sharing them with your colleagues, because in the end of the day, it's the child in the center here. You know, just because you get on well with the child doesn't necessarily mean that other people do, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they can't do. Maybe they can adapt some of the things that you're doing, and maybe they can learn from some of the things that you're doing. And to a certain extent, but you still need the overall support from the policies and procedures you have within the school system in order for that to be achieved.
So I was thinking, how do you get from a controller to a benevolent dictator? How do you get a friend to a benevolent? And what I think about the controller is, it sounds quite easy, but one of the things, a big difference between a controller and a dictator is, in my head, one is human and one is not. What the controller to me is an unemotional robot who is standing at the front of the classroom. I know nothing about them apart from they get angry. Whereas that benevolent dictator, so I mentioned my form tutor liked supported Port Vale, Mr. Spikesman in year five, he liked Manfred Mann, 60s pop group. My year six, Mr. Young, shared lots about him. He was Welsh. He bringed Estini. Oh, there was a Welsh thing they do every year. That came into school. So he brought his Welshness and taught us about Wales and things like that. So that's the thing is, I learned about who they were a little bit. So the big difference between the controller and to me is that part of it is being human. Yeah, sharing something about you that helps you build that connection with the children. Because if they don't know anything about you, there can't be a connection.
Very true. And again, and it isn't to say that not sharing, but being able to do that is not easy for everybody. Everyone's got their own, and some people do like to share. Some people like to be a bit more close. I can only say as a trainer, and if I'm particularly having to go into a school where there's inconsistencies as a trainer, I'm doing some staff training. If I've got these kind of different types of teachers in front of me, and you can kind of see them in the room, what you do tend to find is that what you're basically doing is you're confirming a lot of what they do. You might spark them to do some things different. The friend, what actually gets the friend on board is the band one, band two, that there's some non-negotiables. So everyone gets treated the same way, but other things aren't crimes against humanity. If they feel that there is some consistency on everyone being treated the same way on certain things, he's not pulling the wool over your eyes, he's not getting away with other things, then they're much more likely to sort of firm up their approach and to be more BD, so to speak, in their approach, because they've now got the structure and the flexibility secured, because there's definitely a band one, which are the non-negotiables. The controller is doing what they think is right based on the fact they don't understand needs of the child. And what they need, I keep saying, they need the deeper dive. They need the science. They need to understand why someone can't do something. They need to sometimes see it, you know, on a visual description of how the brain works differently, how the neurotypical is different from the neurodivergent, and why, therefore, it's right to be treating them in a different way. So they need the science. And actually, what can happen is some of the people who were very rigid were very kind of, and let's face it, and some of them themselves have reasons why they're so rigid. we've discussed in other podcasts. They do what they think is right, because that's based on how they think. But once they learn a little bit about how other people might think differently to them, if you like, they can also then become much more, you know, moving into the other camps. And actually, in my experience, sometimes they can become that kind of flip from one side to the other. They become more evangelical than they were before. So once the penny drops, they really can be changed. But they need more time to assimilate the reasons for why. And we've got to sell the idea that it's an investment of time, because the issue is that people think by doing this or doing that, it's gonna take so much time. Sorting out behavior issues, if someone chucks a care, you know, it's gonna take a lot of time. So you've got to sell the idea that by doing things differently, you know, there is a much greater return than the risk of spending time, if that makes sense. It's, you know.
And I suppose with the controller, they're also probably thinking, I've got a lot of mass to get through. I just need to get through this mass. So the focus is on, I've got a lot of stuff to get through, which is, where is that feeling come from? Is it coming from above, or is it more an internal feeling that they literally look at it all again? They're really naughty. I've got to get through this. And it's the chicken and the egg. Do you build the relationship and you'll get through the content much quicker because everyone's on board, or do you get cracking on the content and fight all the way?
Yeah, and as you say, and that's what I was saying before, there does need to be some institutional, what do you call it, direction on this, in terms of what are the priorities, or at least having some flexibility on what someone perceives as the priorities. And also just some, how can I put it, just some different ways of delivering things. It'd be important. I mean, I'm not gonna, as you know, I can tell stories on stories, but I have a couple of on my website, and one's called "You Can't Compete with a Cat in the Playground." If you're interested in that, then obviously check that one out. But you really can't. It's like you can't ignore a wasp in the classroom,
or a seven-legged spider.
In fact, who might have eaten the wasp who ate the. We could do this one. Who ate the cat? Who ate the wasp? And no one ever knew. We could go off there. Yeah. But seven-legged spider is quite, yeah, you're right.
But that's the thing. I think the controller is, just be clear, each one of those people is doing what they think is best.
Of course.
Will either come from personal experiences. And people tell me, someone's really recently, I think it was a podcast I recorded recently, that when they got a job at their first year of teaching, someone told them, you do not smile till Christmas.
That was the advice I had when I was up in Newcastle and I first started teaching. Yeah, you keep it firm, you keep it tight, and then after Christmas, you can loosen up a little bit. Well, you know, I soon found out that being a southern softie in the northeast of England, I wasn't able to convey that very effectively. All the kids thought I was soft because I wore a coat. I mean, because no one in Newcastle wears coats as far as I could see. So I did find that tactic just wouldn't work for me.
And that's the thing. I do think that people see other teachers and try and become them without realizing what's involved. And it might be because they break up a fight and two big lads, it kind of, they can deal with it. Others are scary because they just shout a lot. And when you're an NQT, you can't be either of those people. So it's no point. There's no point even when you're an NQT, there's no point even trying to be a controller. You think I'm going to be a friend. But problem is, I think that often goes a bit wrong because you kind of goes too far and then you get told off. And it could be easy. You could be quite easy to then flip from a friend to a controller just because of some bad feedback and not knowing what else to do. And it's hard, I think, to find that middle ground. Because I said, you can share your personal things and be human. Sounds quite easy, but as teachers, you've got so many pressures above you and around you with how you're supposed to be performing and people telling you different things. Someone told me recently that they were Ofsted inspected, got told their teaching was outstanding. And then somebody from the trust came along and told them their teaching style was completely inadequate. This was within a month of each other and it needs to change when I come back next week.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There's all those kinds of different messages you're getting as a, and that's just a very good one to say. Ofsted say this and someone else says that, and then how does it make you think? And then you're going to flip from one to the other and in order to try and please everyone. I mean, I just want to qualify, though, I didn't explain it before. The reason why no one in Newcastle, particularly under the age of 17, I ever wore a coat, no matter what the temperature was like. So I was wearing a coat, and you're wearing your coat, sir. They used to take the mickey out of me being soft. And you know, you have to find a way that suits your style within the institution you're in and be allowed to flourish. And you make mistakes. The one thing I would say for any young teacher that's moving into this area, when you it's not a shortcut to getting the relationship and rapport, but try and do as many outside activities as you can early on. You know, get the kids and see them outside in situations where it's field trips or sports or volunteer for a club. Because, you know, and particularly if you've got a skill of type, you know, whereas I played rugby and football okay level, and when the kids saw me do that, you know, trap something or kick something, you know, it helps, you know, it does help. You know, they'll see that you have other things that can help you establish that kind of, what's the word? It, not admiration so much, but it's kind of like, well, he's got something is worth listening to.
He's human.
Yeah, and he's got something about him. So she's got something about her, because they can do his other things as well, even though they are a sub and softy wearing a coat.
That's the thing is, so within the first time they learnt you were soft and softy wearing a coat, you were pretty good at football and pretty good at rugby. It's something there I can talk to you about and have a laugh with you about. And as soon as you have that, as soon as you have the rules, you're in that benevolent dictator zone, because they know something about me. We can engage that conversation.
Correct.
We can talk about football. We can talk about rugby. Oh, it's cold today. You're going to need two coats, Mr. O'Regan. You can have lots of fun with that. And you can go, I've actually bought three, sir. But it's that sort of thing is you are a human. And I think to me, that is all my favorite teachers were human. And my last teacher, I'm going to mention, was Welsh, was at college. He was my form tutor and my pure maths. I didn't get pure maths. I just struggled with it. I didn't see the point of it, the relevance, neurodiverse thing. He tried his best, but I knew a few things about him. I knew it was his first job. I used to see him on the bus, so he didn't drive. He was a little bit of a wet lettuce. He was just, he couldn't command a room. He was hard. He couldn't control people. But he still worked. And when I was rude to him, or when I did, I felt bad. And that's the thing is that he had those expectations of me. So he was a benevolent dictator because he had those expectations of me. He could have got me in so much trouble one day, and he didn't. And I went back on my own merit and apologized to him, saying I really shouldn't have said that. And he thanked me. And again, it was a huge level of respect for him, and that just because I knew a few things about him, he treated me as a human. We were at college at this point, so it's easier to treat people like an equal rather than a child thing. He was only a few years older than me. And what's interesting is about 12 years later, after I left college, he added me on Facebook.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So I was probably really rude to him, or really annoying, but he still remembered me.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's amazing that connection you make. And a couple of things, as you know, I'm a big fan of sort of this I sort of call it SF3R, where it's structure, flexibility, which is what, you know, you need to have, particularly with kids with SEM, but all kids. Rapport, relationships, and resilience. And I think you can't go into a class expecting respect. You have to earn it. And I think, you know, that's the point that I think that we're trying to get here. And once you've earned your respect, or you've earned your opportunity to be listened to, you can't just rely on people listening to you. You've got to earn the right to be listened to. And so, you know, from that point of view, there's got to be certain criteria that you need to give them in order for them to do that. You know, I was saying you shouldn't just expect attention, you've got to earn attention. One of the things that I think, you know, one little thing that does work quite well is the issue of and it's hard for young teachers to think to this, but it's to say sometimes you didn't get it right. You know, to say that you didn't get it right, you know, you misread this situation, you didn't quite get it right. And not so much to say, oh, I'm sorry or whatever, but just to admit the fact you didn't get it right. I think to do that can sometimes, as opposed to be something that loses you respect, I think it can gain you a lot of respect.
Without a doubt, that is the biggest thing which will help me. If someone tells me they've made a mistake and they're sorry, that it just goes straight up in my respect books without a doubt. Now, I make mistakes. I admit them. I own up to them. I deal with them. And we move on. And if someone makes a mistake at B squared, it really doesn't bother me because it's not malicious. They didn't do anything. It was a mistake. And they've made a mistake. And they've asked me. I said, fine, we'll do this, 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 and we'll get on with it. And I generally know they won't do it again. But the reason they tell me they've made a mistake is because I tell them I've made a mistake. I've made loads of work or I've done this. And not everyone likes making mistakes. So what I've seen here that some people struggle with admitting they've made a mistake. They like to blame it on someone else. And it's that's a personal thing for them. So some people do not like making mistakes. But if you can teach your children that you have made a mistake and you did something wrong and you did this to fix it and now it's okay, or actually I made a mistake and it did go completely wrong and my whole weekend was ruined, you're opening the door for them to make mistakes and be okay.
Yeah, I honestly think it's to say it's something that I think some people, as you say, will struggle with because it's like somehow you're losing control. And we talked about what controllers are controlling without, you know, and that that level of control is unsustainable. Bottom line, it's unsustainable over a period of time because we'll all make mistakes. And I think, you know, being not happy to admit it, but being able to admit it shows that, you know, that we don't get it right all the time, and it will gain you respect. But as you're right, and that's why we're not saying, you know, we're not trying to put people in to say, look, you're doing this right or doing this wrong. We're just trying to say that I think what I've seen over the years, and after being ahead and after going to many other schools, I've seen the teachers that are most successful, if you like, with the students that have the SEN issues. And we're not just talking about, you know, we're not talking about just SEMH issues. We're talking about dyslexia, dyspraxia. They're more flexible. The other thing, though, as a quick anecdote, you talked about teachers being passionate about their subject and about that science teacher who was slightly quirky and everything. That is also attractive to students. Again, if I go back to my Newcastle days, because now you've just awakened some memories there, I once did the bell jar experiment. Now, the bell jar experiment is not a particularly exciting experiment. It's just a big glass bell, and inside of it, there is sort of big glass surround in a bell jar shape, and you've got this little bell underneath it, which is ringing, because what you do is you are evacuating the air to show that sound doesn't travel through a vacuum. So you have this jar, you hold it up, you're ringing the bell, and eventually it all goes quiet because there's no air, so the bell can't ring in air. And it's a bit of a boring experiment. The kids are like, oh, yeah, well, that wasn't very good. So you've got to make it a bit more interesting, like saying, I don't know, in space, no one can hear you scream or something like that, you know, from Alien, which you do that. But anyway, I was at the front of the class. I did this. I had three forms I had to teach the same lesson to in the week, year nine students. And I'd done this twice before, and I was a bit bored by doing it anyway. Anyway, one day when I was doing it the third time, I was doing this with the bell, and the bell kept ringing for much longer. And in the minute, what happened was the whole jar blew up and all the glass went flying around, cut my hand a little bit, and I was left carrying this little bell without a bell jar in it. Because what I'd done is there were two tubes that were going, one was pushing air in and one was sucking it out. So this time, instead of sucking air out, I had put the air in. So I blew up, this was probably an £85 worth of science equipment, and I blew the bell and was left. And the reason why I'm explaining this is that I went in and I thought I was never going to work in science ever again. And my head of department just, you know, luckily laughed at me. But the best advantage was that everyone came to my class after that for science, thinking they weren't sure what was going to happen next. And I get emails to this day from students, where there was one recently from a guy who's a professor at a Swedish university, reminding me when I blew the bell jar up. I'm not advising you to do these things, I'm saying, but if you want to get rapport with students and you want them to enjoy coming to your class, keep them guessing.
Yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt. And that's the thing is, you teachers are remembered for life.
Yeah,
there's not many professions you can say that for.
Yeah, everyone, as you know, everyone remembers, you know, their best teacher, or, you know, you laugh about the other ones. But you make an, you know, you, as you know, these are the, and even if you have a child, I know many of you will appreciate this, who, you know, you remain timeless in their eyes. And, you know, and these are the students that I have seen, students on the underground, or people and young men on the underground in particular, who will come up to me and say, "Hello, sir." And these were the ones who were calling me all this, that, and the other 20 years ago. And they recognize the fact that you hung in there and you stayed in there for them, and you treated them with, you know, with respect, with, you know, as a huge, and you took them as individuals. They remember that, and it comes back, and they might not be giving you the feedback that you think you should get right now, but they will remember that, and you will get that in the future.
Definitely, definitely. Fintan, thank you for coming on the show. Fintan's given me a load of links. So he's linked to the teacher's toolkit book that he mentioned. He's also given some stuff from Project Top Traits from an Effective Teacher and things like that. So as always, you'll find those in the show notes wherever you listen to the podcast or on the website. As always, thank you for listening. Please follow us on social media, on Twitter at The Sendcast, Facebook The Sendcast, and Instagram The Sendcast. And let us know what you want us to discuss. It's always up to you. If you want to say, talk about this, we will find a guest, or I'll find another guest, and we'll find a way of covering that cover. So do let us know what you want to hear about. And as always, be squared. We are here to help you show progress for your pupils with SEN, but also not just your pupils with SEN. We can now be used to assess progress for all pupils in primary settings, which to me makes it more inclusive, because you can use one system for all pupils, tailored to those who need the extra support and for those working at your typical rates of progress. So if you want to find out more about B Squared, you can book a free online meeting with me, and I can take you through our products. And you'll find on our website lots of information about our online training, our blog, and our webinars, all on the website. And you'll find a link to the website and to book a meeting with me in the show notes. So thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Sendcast. It's goodbye from me.
And goodbye from Dale.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.